like to convene the Ways and Means Committee. We were delayed. I don't know what the problems were, but we had a team up there working on the technology part of it. Otherwise, we would have started a little bit earlier. We do have a quorum present. Representative Hurtos.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I just wanted to express my thanks, perhaps on behalf of our caucus, maybe all of the people in here, for your wisdom and intellect, probably intuition, on calling this meeting to order at 10:30. You must have known it was going to be a snow event today.
Well, you know, I haven't lived any place other than Minnesota, so you just sort of are cautious this time of year, let me just put it that way. But that was actually, I have to give credit to the woman to my right, made that suggestion, Nancy Conley.
Under the bus.
Well, so I can't take credit for it, but it's a good idea this time of year.
Well, of the hour and 50 minutes one way here, I never went less than five, so that was a good thing. I didn't come to a complete stop ever.
And knowing that even though it was starting at 10:30, I left home shortly after 7 a.m. this morning to make sure I was here, because I watched the early morning news and they were talking about accidents, spin-outs, and so on. But we do have to give some credit. We've got some folks here from northern Minnesota that made it in, and the worst of it last night and this morning was up north. So how was it in Duluth?
Mr. Chair, I came down last night because I saw the weather forecast, and I knew if Representative Eklund was going to be here, I had to be here. It's further to drive.
Did you come down last night, too?
I did, Mr. Chair.
Okay. So I don't know if we have any other northern Minnesotans here or not, but we have at least two. But we do have a quorum, and thank you to everyone who's here. And we will get started then. We don't have any minutes in the packets. We'll approve previous minutes when we convene in February. On February the 11th or shortly thereafter, we'll have our first committee meeting, and we'll take up previous minutes. So we are going to have an overview of the budget. There's been a fair amount of publicity about it already, being that it was released last week. But the tradition of the Ways and Means Committee under both caucuses is that shortly after the forecast comes out, we do have MMB come in and give us an overview. Oh, okay. Should we point that out? Okay. Ms. Conley pointed out that she made an error on the agenda, that it's the November forecast, not the February forecast that we're talking about. That'd be a little bit early, but we will have a hearing in a couple of months on the February forecast. So if the folks that are going to testify could come forward. And Commissioner Franz, are you going to be the lead-off then? Your name is listed first.
Mr. Chair, I will try, but I will quickly hand it off to the smart people on both sides of me so we can get the information you really want. But thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning, and thank you, members, for all being here today. We're happy to present the November forecast today, and we'll wait a few months for the February forecast. But one of the things that is so critical about today's last week's forecast was it came at a time when we were able to make a contribution or allocation to the budget reserve account, as I'll talk a little bit about. But, you know, as we sort of said last week, the budget outlook for Minnesota has improved, and Dr. Columbakidis, I need some water. I need to do a few laps around the Capitol before I can say that. Dr. Columbakidis will talk about the economic aspects, and Britta Raton, the budget director, we'll talk about the budget, in particular the expenditure side. But one of the things that we were really pleased to see was that the $1.3 billion surplus forecasted for 20 and 21 provided enough balance to make a payment to the allocation to the budget reserve. And now we've hit the budget reserve target of almost $2.4 billion. Which is what we were striving to get, to have a rainy day fund in the event that we have an economic downturn. One of the things that we talked a little bit about last week was the fact that so many states have been able, have started using, setting up more significant rainy day funds across the country. And that has allowed them to avoid that difficulty that many of us around the table, I see a lot of familiar faces from 2011, many of us have walked through that situation where you have a large deficit, at that time $6.2 billion, and you have to make changes, and you have to make them very quickly. So under the scenario that we've put forward with our budget reserve that we'll talk a little bit more about later, provides us some flexibility in the event of an economic downturn. The other thing that I just wanted to mention was that the budget reserve policy that we have is based upon a percentage of the general fund revenues in a biennium. So that provides some further protection against the risk of a growing budget. So as our budget grows, so does the target, because it's a percentage of the revenues. And so every November or every September, Dr. Columbakidis's team analyzes whether the volatility of the revenue stream has changed, whether that percentage should change or not change. But it's one way that we provide some risk analysis about what happens in the event that the revenues change dramatically. But with that, what I'd like to do now is turn it over to Budget Director Eitan to walk through the projected balance, the budget reserve, and then go on.
Yeah, and I should ask, Commissioner, it's your preference. Do you want to have your team entertain questions as you go, or do you want to wait until you're done with the presentation? As chair, I can go either way.
Mr. Chair, really, it's the prerogative of the chair. We're happy to take questions as we go along. I think.
Well, why don't we find some middle ground and just say that unless you've got a real pressing question as they're doing the presentation, we'll wait until the end for questions. And then if necessary, we can entertain a question, but otherwise we'll try to wait until you're done.
Thank you. Actually, Mr. Chair, this presentation should go fairly quickly. It's I think we'll get to that end pretty quickly. Thank you.
Good morning. My name is Britta Rayton. I'm State Budget Director at MMB. I'm going to just walk through a high-level look at the numbers in fiscal years 20 and 21. So what this slide is showing is the change in the budgetary balance in 20 and 21, and it compares the end of session estimates to the current estimates in this forecast. And then the right-hand column reflects the change between the end of session and the forecast. So the bottom row of the chart shows the budgetary balance, and in the middle column, that's where you can see the current projection of $1.332 billion that's available for 20 and 21. And this is an increase of $1.09 billion over the end of session estimate. And this is also after the additional allocation to the budget reserve. So as you can see in the change column, the biggest driver of the change is $891 million in an increase in the carry forward into the beginning balance. So this is money carrying forward from the close of fiscal year 19 and contributing an increase to the beginning balance for 20 and 21. And of that $891 million, the majority is due to higher total revenue than previously forecast in fiscal year 19. Revenue projections are also increasing in the forecast for the current biennium, so in years 20 and 21, by $501 million. And expenditure estimates have declined only slightly by $7 million. And we'll talk more about the drivers of those changes a bit later in the presentation. The next line shows the change in the budget reserve. Under existing statute, we either allocate 33% of the balance or the amount necessary to reach the reserve target. And in this case, we allocated the amount necessary to reach the reserve target, and the target is $2.359 billion currently. So we allocated $284 million to the reserve. The next line shows $350 million in the cash flow account, and this is unchanged from end of session estimates. And then the next line shows the change in the stadium reserve balance. The balance is projected to increase by $25 million in fiscal years 20 and 21, reaching $124 million by the end of 2021. And this is due to increased gambling tax projections relative to the previous forecast. And then again, the bottom line shows the budgetary balance of $1.332 billion. This next slide just provides a bit more detail about the allocation to the budget reserve from the forecast. The budget reserve law that was passed in 2014 establishes a reserve target that's annually determined, and the commissioner talked a bit about this. It's based on an assessment of the volatility in our revenue structure, and it's an assessment that's done by Dr. Kolumbakidis' team every September. So the target is not a dollar amount, it's a percentage of total revenues in the general fund. So currently the target is 4.9% of biennial revenues. So given the current revenue projections, the reserve target equals $2.359 billion. Prior to this forecast, we had $2.075 billion in the reserve. So before the allocation to the reserve, the forecast balance in fiscal years 20 and 21 is $1.616 billion. And as I said, statute directs either 33% or the amount to reach the reserve target. So in this case, if we had done 33%, it would have been $533 million. We didn't need to allocate that much to reach the target. So the allocation to the reserve with this forecast is $284 million. And now I will hand it over to Dr. Kolumbakidis to walk through the economy and revenue forecast changes.
Thank you. I'm Laura Kolumbakidis, state economist, and I'm glad to be here today to talk to you about the economic and revenue forecast. So I'm going to start with the U.S. economy. I'll move to Minnesota's economy, and then I'll talk about the revenue change. The first chart compares the current U.S. real GDP forecast by our consulting firm, IHS, to their prior forecast. So the dark bars show the history and their current November 2019 forecast, and then the light bars show their February forecast, which is the one that informed our prior forecast. So if you just focus on the right-hand side of the chart, the years 19 to 23, you can see that the outlook for U.S. economic growth this year has slightly weakened, and the outlook for the remaining years of our forecast has slightly improved since our forecast was last prepared on February. Lower actual growth through most of this year led IHS to lower their expectations for 2019 real GDP growth from 2.4% in February's outlook to 2.3% now. Their outlook for growth in each year from 20 to 23 is higher than in February, driven primarily by a stronger consumer spending forecast. If you look at the current forecast for 19 to 23, so the dark bars on the right-hand side of the forecast, or right-hand side of the chart, you can see the pattern of slowing growth through our planning horizon carries over from the prior forecast. That slowdown occurs, so just the deceleration going from 2.9 to 1.5. That slowing occurs as the contribution to growth from federal fiscal stimulus declines. Tariffs and trade policy uncertainty undermine business investment. Interest rates gradually rise. And growth in household wealth slows. So household wealth continues to grow, but it grows at a slower pace. After mid-2020, a decline in the U.S. labor force participation rate that's demographically driven, so it's about baby boomers retiring, that decline further slows the economy. So the downshift continues with annual real GDP growth expected to decelerate from 2.9% annually in 2018 to 1.5% in 23. And then the history of the chart, the years since the recession, illustrates one of the risks of the forecast. The dotted line, as I've shown you before, is at 3.1%. That's annual average real GDP growth for the 20 years prior to the recession. And the point there is simply to illustrate that the growth that we used to be able to expect is higher than the growth that we are expecting going forward. And when the economy is growing slower, there's not as much margin for error. It's hard to recover from a setback or a negative shock than when the growth is higher. So in addition, the U.S. expansion, as you know, is the longest on record. So a mature low growth expansion is particularly vulnerable when negative shocks occur. The relatively small changes in the U.S. GDP forecast are the result of some offsetting changes in some of the components of GDP. Specifically, a stronger forecast for consumer spending offsets lower expected growth in business investment. So this chart shows the forecast change for U.S. real consumer spending. The gray bars show the February outlook. The dark bars show the current outlook. Now, consumer spending constitutes about two-thirds of real GDP. And IHS expects consumers to remain the primary contributors to growth in the economy. IHS has raised their expectations for real consumer spending growth by between 0.4 and 0.8 percentage points in each year of the forecast, and that influences our forecast for Minnesota's sales tax receipts. The stronger forecast growth, so the stronger consumer spending forecast, is supported by rising incomes, falling gas prices, a lower interest rate path. So interest rates are expected to rise, but relative to the prior forecast, that path is a little lower, and rising household wealth. And when wealth grows, for example, for Americans, wealth is primarily their value of their homes and then values of retirement savings, stock market portfolios, financial assets. So when wealth grows from rising home values and financial asset values, consumers tend to spend more. And that positive wealth effect has been an important contributor to economic growth during this expansion. But it is at risk if wealth declines or if policy uncertainty makes consumers jittery. The stronger forecast for real consumer spending, as I said, offsets a reduced forecast for business investment. And that has been encumbered by a slowdown in manufacturing, including declining manufacturing employment at the U.S. level, a strong U.S. dollar that dampens demand for exports, and trade policy uncertainty. Not knowing what the future trade policy playing field looks like makes business owners postpone expansion plans and hold off on investment. So now we move to Minnesota and compare Minnesota to the U.S. In this chart, I compare the headline unemployment rate for the United States to Minnesota. The U.S. is the light line and Minnesota is the dark line. Of course, the vertical gray bars are the recessions. The white space between the bars represents those recovery and expansion periods between recessions. So Minnesota's steady economic performance continues, even as the U.S. expansion has surpassed record length. Throughout the expansion, Minnesota has steadily added jobs, driving the unemployment rate well below the U.S. rate. Minnesota's unemployment rate reached an 18-year low of 2.8% in June of 18. It began gradually rising a year ago, reaching the current rate of 3.2%, 0.4 percentage points below the U.S. rate. The recent increase, as you can see on the right-hand side of the chart, you see that increase from December 18, you see the dip up. That recent increase in our unemployment rate coincides with an increase in our labor force participation rate, which is the share of the over 16 population that's either working or looking for work. Our labor force participation is consistently above the U.S. rate and among the highest among states. But since December 18, it has inched even higher to reach 70.3%, which is 7 percentage points above the U.S. rate and the second highest among U.S. states. So coincidental upticks in the unemployment rate and labor force participation rate mean that we had some new entrants into the workforce, and some of those new entrants didn't immediately find jobs. Creative efforts to match them to jobs will lower our unemployment rate and support employment growth. This chart illustrates another aspect of Minnesota's tight labor market. The gray bars, the height of the gray bars shows the total number of unemployed workers, so the number of workers associated with that rate you saw in the previous chart, and the gray bars shows the number of job vacancies, and both of these numbers are statewide. I've given you some history on this chart so you can see how different the relationship between the number of unemployed workers and job vacancies was prior to the recession, and of course, especially during the recession. The dark bars, you can see at the far end, the last data point on the chart, the 19 data there. You can see the gray bar has gone up a little bit, so that's that uptick in unemployment I mentioned before. We have a few more unemployed workers than we had before. But the number of job vacancies has also increased, and that number of job vacancies has risen to a very high level, illustrating that there is high demand for workers in Minnesota. For the last few years, the ratio of unemployed job seekers to open positions across the state has been less than one, so a measure of the tight labor market, meaning there are fewer unemployed job seekers than there are open positions across the state. And that ratio is now 0.7. The tight labor market is being felt across Minnesota, as both the Twin Cities and Greater Minnesota have fewer unemployed persons per job vacancy, fewer unemployed persons than job vacancies. The large number of open positions across the state, as I said, illustrates a strong demand for labor, and we expect that demand to persist as long as the U.S. expansion does. But baby boom retirements have made it difficult to match that demand with increased labor supply. So recent increases in migration to the state have come at the perfect time and represent a bright spot for Minnesota's economic outlook. For the last 2 years, so for 17 and 18, the last 2 years of data, Minnesota has attracted more new residents than we lost to other states, reversing a 15-year trend of negative domestic net in-migration and making us an outlier in the Midwest. Newcomers from around the country and around the world made 2017 the largest year for net migration to Minnesota in nearly three decades. Now, that's not the only component of population growth. The largest component of population growth is natural growth, which is births less deaths. But those data are about migration specifically. So finally, I'll summarize our revenue forecast. Total general fund revenues for the current biennium are now forecast to be, as you heard earlier, $501 million more than the February forecast. So we have higher forecasts for individual income tax, sales tax, and other taxes, and a lower forecast for corporate tax revenue. The largest dollar amount change is the individual income tax, which is forecast to generate $493 million more in the remainder of FY 20 to 21 than we had estimated in February after adjusting for 2019 legislative changes. We ended fiscal year 19 with more income tax receipts than we had forecast, indicating higher tax liability for tax year 2018, which is the base year of this forecast. That higher base plus stronger forecast growth in non-wage income raised the income tax forecast. A similar story applies to the sales tax. General sales tax revenue for the current biennium is now forecast to be $252 million more than the prior estimate. That increase reflects higher than expected receipts so far in this fiscal year and a higher forecast for taxable sales compared to February. So that's consistent with that higher U.S. consumer spending forecast I showed earlier. Corporate franchise tax is expected to generate $294 million less than the prior forecast. This story is the reverse of the sales tax story. That reduced forecast reflects receipts so far this fiscal year that are below our prior forecast and a lower forecast for corporate profits. That's from the U.S. Macro forecast. So let me highlight some of the risks of this forecast. I mentioned the risk that consumers were the champions. Thank you. Were the champions of this economic recovery and the main source of sales tax revenue, the risk that they get spooked by policy uncertainty or negative wealth effects. This forecast incorporates all U.S. tariffs and other countries' retaliatory measures that have been put into place to date, as well as the December 15th step in U.S. tariffs on Chinese imports. But as you know, U.S. trade policy, especially regarding China, but regarding some of our other trading partners as well, has been in flux. And uncertainty imposes costs on businesses that have to address supply chain disruptions. Businesses already appear to be putting investment plans on hold, and prolonged uncertainty will exacerbate that investment slowdown. On the other hand, alleviation of trade policy uncertainty is a source of upside potential to this forecast. Geopolitical events can derail global growth that is already showing signs of slowing. For example, if the UK exits the European Union without an agreement, a disruption to exports could follow. And then finally, with 19 months before the end of the current biennium, even small changes in assumed growth rates in particularly volatile income sources, such as capital gains or corporate profits, could materially alter the budget picture through our planning horizon. So we'll pass it back to Budget Director Raton.
Again, my name is Britta Raton, State Budget Director. We're going to pivot to the expenditure side of the forecast. And as I mentioned before, this expenditure side, it shows very little change overall since the end of session, just a $7 million change. There is, however, more significant movement in specific bill areas, and they are offsetting each other. So I'll walk through some detail there. E-12 education spending is $24 million below end of session estimates for 2021. And the biggest drivers of the change include a $30 million reduction in general education spending compared to the previous estimates, and this is just due to a decrease in projected pupil growth. So pupils are still growing, the number of students are still growing, but at a slightly slower pace than our previous forecast. There's also a $16 million reduction in special education spending estimates, and this is due to slower than projected growth in district spending. So actual spending at the district level was slightly slower last year, or the growth in that spending was slightly slower than we had previously projected. These reductions are partially offset by $30 million in additional spending for Safe Schools programming. The 2019 legislature made this funding contingent upon the general fund balance at close being greater than what we had projected at end of session, and that was in fact the case. And so that contingent appropriation for Safe Schools funding was made in 20 and 21. So $30 million of spending for Safe Schools was appropriated, and that was not counted in end of session estimates. So that's shown as an increase. Property tax aids and credits has increased $61 million compared to previous estimates. And this is largely due to increased projections for the homestead property tax refund and increased projections for tax refund interest payments. Moving to HHS spending, HHS spending is $97 million below end of session estimates, and this is primarily due to lower enrollment in MA basic care programs focused on people with disabilities and families with children. So the enrollment in basic care for people with disabilities is 5.2% lower than previous forecast. And this is due to a continued diversion of certain individuals from this category to the adults without children category. And the reason this is happening is that the barriers to getting into the adults without children program are just lower. It has quicker and easier eligibility for individuals, and it does not require a disability designation, and it has higher income and asset limits. And this actually creates savings for the state, because in the adults without children category, we receive a higher federal match. And so that's what's generating the savings there. Enrollment in families with children basic care is down 1% per year on average, and this is primarily due to favorable economic conditions. Moving to the debt service line, debt service is projected to be $51 million below previous estimates, and this reduction is primarily due to lower bond interest rates than were previously forecast. So when we sold bonds in August, we had lower interest rates on those bonds than when we included in our previous forecast. And we also, in August, had a smaller bond sale than we were previously forecasting as well. And then the final category is other, which captures all the other bill areas in the general fund budget. And the spending in this category is $104 million above end of session projections. And there are two main reasons for this change in the other bill areas. The first is other contingent appropriations. So we talked about the contingent appropriation in the E12 bill area. There were two others in law as of the end of session. And because our balance was in fact greater at the end of session than we were previously projecting, those contingent appropriations were made. And one was a $20 million appropriation for the disaster assistance contingency account at the Department of Public Safety. The second was $13 million for Metro Transit at the Met Council. The second driver of the change is $71 million in unspent appropriations from fiscal year 19 that are carrying forward into fiscal year 20. So most appropriations cancel at the end of the biennium, but some specific appropriations have authority to carry forward across the biennium. And when that happens, we are assuming that that money, as of the end of session fund balance, we're assuming that that money is going to be spent in the year that it's appropriated, but when it carries forward, it increases the spending estimates for the biennium that it carries forward into. So the two most significant areas of carry forward were $32 million for the business and community development programs at DEED. These appropriations are allowed to carry forward because much of that economic development work takes a longer time horizon to plan for and to get programmed. So those appropriations have carry forward, as well as $23 million in operating appropriations for the legislature. So moving to the next slide, we return to a view of total revenues and expenditures in the general fund. And this slide provides a look at the planning estimates for fiscal years 22 and 23. You can see in the first column the available balance of $1.332 billion for 20 and 21. And in the presentation of 22 and 23, that $1.332 billion is assumed to carry forward. So what that means is that that $1.332 billion is a part of the beginning balance that we show in this slide for 22 and 23, meaning it's built into that $4.164 billion that's shown as a beginning balance in 22 and 23. So that means that the $1.919 billion, that's the available balance that's projected in 22-23, assumes that the $1.332 billion in 20 and 21 is not spent, but is carried forward into the 22-23 biennium. So given that, and since that can be somewhat distorting when people look at it, we also provided a balance without carry forward number, and that's $587 million. So that shows the impact if the $1.332 billion was spent in 20 and 21. Also in the 22-23 column, we show forecast revenues and expenditures for that biennium. So when we compare just the forecast revenues and forecast expenditures, we call that structural balance because we're taking out of the calculation the carry forward from previous years and all of the changes in the reserve levels. So when we're looking at just the comparison of the forecast expenditures to the forecast revenues in 22-23, we do have structural balance in the out years, but it's very narrow. It's $220 million. That's the difference between those two numbers. Moving to the budget reserve line, you can see that the reserve declines in 22-23 by $491 million. And this change is due to a law passed last session that reduces the reserve by $491 million in fiscal year 22. And if you recall, this was done to ensure that the planning estimates in 22-23 were balanced at the end of last session. So even though we've reached the reserve target with this current forecast, the reserve balance is scheduled to be reduced at the beginning of the next biennium. The stadium reserve line shows the reserve is projected to grow to $248 million by the end of 2023. And this growth is due to continued increases in projected gambling tax revenues, along with the fact that beginning in fiscal year 21, the state begins retaining sales tax from the city of Minneapolis. And this is to cover the payments that the state is currently remitting on behalf of the city for stadium expenses. So returning to the balance without carry forward number of $587 million, as well as the overall budgetary balance in 22-23 of the $1.919 billion, it's important to point out that the $491 million reduction in the reserve is contributing to that number. So if the reserve were restored in 22-23, that number would be reduced by $491 million. And then finally on this slide, we do include an estimate of inflation for fiscal years 22 and 23. And this is just to give a sense of the cost pressures that exist out in the planning biennium because there's not a budget set yet for those years. So inflation is generally not included on our expenditure side of the forecast. There are some formulas that build in an inflationary measure, but in most cases, there is not inflation included on the expenditure side. And so this is a application of a CPI level of inflation to those appropriations in 22-23 that do not have some inflationary component to the formula. So this is just to give a sense of the cost pressures in 22-23. Now I'll pass it back to the commissioner.
Mr. Chair, members, let me just summarize a few points so we can open it up for questions. I just want to really talk about three primary things, and you can see at the end here we just highlighting the $491 million reserve change. One of the reasons that the money has been put in there, and the statute requires that it be used in the event of an economic downturn, and it has some criteria to be used for that. So we believe that it's prudent to put the money back in the reserve account for that reason. It was used, as Budget Director Raton mentioned, to help us balance 22 and 23 at the end of session, but given the resources that we have, we do think it's appropriate to put it back in there. The other thing, too, is I just want to focus a little bit on the long-range planning. In Minnesota, we plan at least for 4 years, sometimes more than that, actually. And the goal here is not to budget for 1 year, but to budget for at least four and look out into the horizon. I think that's one of the reasons we've been able to have surpluses after surpluses. And one of the reasons we did what we did at the end of session was to make sure we had a budgetary balance in 22 and 23. We made the reserve change. So those, keeping the eye on the ball in terms of the long-term planning, and really we think is the smart move. We also believe that a capital budget, a bonding bill or investment bill, whatever you want to call it, is another smart investment to make this next session. We didn't make one this year in 2019, so we believe that given the interest rates that we were able to get in August, there's a triple A index, a fund index for interest rates. We actually beat that index in August in terms of what we were able to get for bond sales, 1% and 2%. So with that kind of interest rate right now, with the resources we have available, we do believe that we can make a robust bonding bill and in the long term make some of these long-term investments in the state of Minnesota that we think will continue to help Minnesota attract workers from around the country and around the state. As Professor Klumbakidis mentioned, we are facing the wonderful aspect of a positive net migration from domestic folks. And as we attract people to Minnesota for the jobs and the opportunities and the beautiful weather that we have every day, it really provides, it's something that I think we once again need to think to the long term. What's going to keep that trend happening? And we do believe that investing in education, healthcare, and those things is the right thing to do. We are concerned about the inflation, as Budget Director Raton mentioned, and so we'll be looking to talk to about ways to maybe we should restore that to the process, or at least talk about making sure we account for that, because inflation is real and it really does make a difference in our budget. So with that, I'm happy to turn it over for questions.
Commissioner, I think I'll ask you, maybe being it's kind of wrapped up with the comment on the inflation, if you could give us a little bit of history there, because there was a time when we did adjust for inflation, and then there was a change a number of years ago, and if I recall, I think the Council of Economic Advisors in their report to us virtually with each and every forecast remind us that we should include inflation. And so basically my question is so a bit of the history and what's in and what's out, because there are some accounts that are adjusted for inflation and others that are not. So I'm not sure how those decisions were made in terms of how given activities qualified for an inflationary adjustments and others did not.
Well, Mr. Chair, thank you for that question. I do think that, I think it was 2002 or 2003, some folks may remember that better than I, when the inflation was removed from the expenditure portion of the budget, and it's been that way ever since. And so obviously it's an issue we have some concern about. I think Budget Director Raton can give you a better indication of sort of what's in and what's out of that calculation.
At a high level, I mean, I wouldn't expect all the detail, but just a few examples perhaps.
Sure, Mr. Chair. So what includes inflation are those places where there's a formula in law that's either including an inflationary measure, an example of that would be the special education formula in education, or formulas that are based on cost. So there's formulas within our healthcare area where we pay based on cost. And so as costs rise, we pay more, and if inflation is just naturally accommodated through that. Our debt service forecast, we project out actual debt service payments, so there's no need to apply an inflationary factor to that. So we look at the places where there are formulas in law or where we pay based on actual cost, and then when we provide our estimate of inflation on everything else, we exclude those from the calculation because they already have some component of inflation built in.
Okay, so for example, now bonding, I think when I looked at your report, you pointed out that that was factored out, would be an example of one that when you're calculating the number of a billion plus, because you're, when you issue the bonds, the interest rate is fixed, so that's factored out then?
Okay. Mr. Chair, correct, yes.
If I could go back to that 491 and just clarify for the committee, what's happening there with the $491 million and how current law applies to addressing that issue?
Yes, Mr. Chair. So the deal that was reached at the end of session to get to our budget deal in taking out the $491 million on July 1, 2021, fiscal year 22, as Britta Raton, the budget director, mentioned, that was designed to make sure we had a budgetary balance in 22 and 23. But that did not change the current law otherwise with respect to the budget reserve. So going forward in the next, the year after that, in the November forecast, if there is a target and it hasn't been reached, and the target, and there's a call to put more money in because we haven't reached the target, and there's a November balance, and once again, 33% of that balance would go toward the reserve. So the current budget reserve process is in place, hasn't changed. It was just that one-time direction to remove $491 million on July 1, 2021 to be used in and make it made available as assets or resources in 21. Fiscal year 22.
Just to clarify, what's the standing of that 491 as we sit here now?
So it is a future change. So right now, the The reserve is $2.359 billion, and it will not change, but on July 1, 2021, it will drop by $491 million, and that $491 million will be available in the general fund.
And then with the following forecast, the November forecast after July, if resources are there, when I ask about current law, then would that $491 be paid back or part of it paid back at that point? I'm just curious as to how current law applies to how that's...
Mr. Chair, yeah, so November of 2021, if there's a forecast balance, 33% of that forecast balance will go into the reserve if there's a... if there's room, and there would be room if the 491 came out, and it would go, it would just be the 33% though. It wouldn't just replace the 491, it would just put in 33% of whatever that balance was in November
of
2021.
Theoretically could apply toward the 491, and that would continue to happen until it's ultimately paid back to the reserve to make the reserve full.
Yeah, the formula will ignore the 491 and operate going forward and see if there's a, if there's any gap there, if there's any, if we're not at the target, that November balance allocation will operate every year that there's less than the target amount in the reserve, regardless of what we do with the 491.
Before we go to other questions, just a comment. I've always been interested in having a reserve, and sometimes I share maybe more frequently than I should some history. But I was here when we didn't have a reserve and we had six special sessions. We were continually trying to balance the budget. And the governor at the time, when he left office, was asked by one of the reporters if he would do anything different than what he had done during his term of office. And he said, yes, I would have a reserve. And that was... governor from the other side of the aisle, so I think we can say in a bipartisan way there's recognition of the importance of a reserve, and I'm pleased that we're reaching the target. So that's my editorial comment for the morning, I guess, and we'll start with Representative Hertaus.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I have two questions. Looking at how the general fund budget has grown over the last 10 years and the amount of money that would have been required to meet that full funded budget reserve amount, the growth in our state general fund spending and revenues is approaching nearly, by my calculations, almost an additional $1 billion that's required to be in the budget reserve. And in many respects, that competes with legislative priorities, whatever they are. I noticed that the percentage required has jumped from 4.3% to 4.9%. That 0.6% is 13.9% increase in required amount of budget reserve. Maybe you could talk a little bit why that percentage has increased, how it got increased, you know, who authorized that, how that comes about. My second question relates to the conversation that we've had about positive net migration to Minnesota, and I don't doubt that that's true, but IRS data that I've kind of crunched is suggesting that Minnesota's losing about $1 billion a year of taxable gross income in net migration out of the state. So wouldn't it be wiser to measure this metric about gross taxable income and the growth of it, as opposed to net migration in or out, as to who these people are or what their incomes are? It would seem that it's important to understand that number, because so much of our general fund revenue is reliant disproportionately from other states on the individual income tax.
Mr. Chair and member, I will take a shot at 1A and let the budget director, Professor Columbakitas, take 1B and maybe 2. So 1A, I would disagree with the fact that the reserve operates to not support legislative priorities. Actually, that's exactly what it's designed to do. So when there's a drop in revenues and precipitously the revenues drop, the reserve fund is there to keep the funding to higher education, to the educational facilities, to the programs that are in place, which the legislature passed. So it's designed as a measure to allow those programs that the legislature voted on to be funded, until to give the legislature some time to adjust to the new economic situation that at the time presents itself. So I think actually the reserve really is the ultimate in affirming the legislative priorities, and that's why we think it's there. But I'll let Dr. Columbakidis answer the other part of that.
Sure. Representative members of the committee. So 1B, I think, is about the percentage of the budget reserve. So the 4.3%, let's go back to where that is on the slide. So the budget reserve balance prior to this forecast was 2.075, which was 4.3% of general fund revenues. That's not what the target was. Okay. That's just what was in there. And so the target, my office sets the target as a percentage of general fund revenues based on our analysis of the volatility of the revenue system. And so in our September report, we reanalyzed the volatility of the revenue system and set the target at 4.9%. And so we have been adjusting that target with our September reports since the law was passed that we required us to. But we have the state has never met that target until now. So does that answer your question about that?
Yeah, thank you.
Okay. And then the question about in-migration. The data that I reported are census, our American Consumer Survey data from the census about population change, and so it doesn't include the income change that you're talking about, which comes from the IRS. And so when those data are updated, it will be interesting to see how those change. The reason I put that population change or the migration change information in the section about labor market is because it's helpful to us to see people coming to the state regardless of what their income is, because we need the workers from the cities out to greater Minnesota. So that's why I thought that looked like a bright spot for Minnesota. And then throughout this period, during that period when our net in-migration was negative, but definitely into this period where our net in-migration is positive, our income tax receipts have grown. So the regardless of whether that's new people coming in or it's people who have been here and their incomes grow, the receipts have grown during that time.
Representative Hertog.
Thank you, and I appreciate the explanation on the percentages. And I just, not really a rebuttal, and I agree with you, Commissioner Franz, as to what you said about that it allows us to establish those priorities. Yes, it does, but not all legislative priorities with regard to partisan priorities are enabled to be enacted oftentimes because of the growing budget reserves. So I guess I would say there are things that are statutorily part of our or constitutionally required for us to do, such as transportation and education, things like that, but there might be some other areas that some of us would like to see some progress with regard to taxes, and obviously when there's a shortage of money, tax reforms are usually off the table. Thank you.
Representative Mariani.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Kalambokidis. I'm a Chicagoan, so I grew up with, I suspect, Greek, yes. I grew up with a large Greek community nearby, so I feel like at home here. Hopefully quick and just big macro economics questions, because I want to get an airing and a feel for how our state is evolving and perhaps what makes our state unique. Particularly relative to the numbers before us. So in no particular order, you talked about one of the uncertainty elements has to do with tariff impacts, and some of that, of course, is speculative because that's kind of a moving thing, and then lately it seems to be moving quite a bit. I'm wondering if you have any information to share about what are Minnesota's tariffs sort of sensitive impact areas. What are our biggest sectors that are subject to that kind of uncertainty in our state.
Representative, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. So there are two different impacts of tariffs and current trade policy on industries that are trade affected or trade impacted. And one is the direct tariffs. You know, how much more money are you paying for, if you're a manufacturer, paying for those intermediate goods coming in from other countries? And then how much of that can you pass forward to your customers? There's also the effect of retaliatory tariffs from our trading partners, and how much that is reducing demand for the goods that we're trying to export out of Minnesota. So that's the direct impact. And then there's also the impact of trade policy uncertainty. So simply not knowing at any given point what policy is going to be. And imagine being somebody in a trade-affected industry, and the trade-affected industries would be agriculture, manufacturing, logistics, and transportation, and thinking that you've got your supply chain figured out, or you've got your customer figured out, you've developed a customer base in another country, and now you're not sure if that's going to carry forward for the next year or what's going to happen. And so those two impacts, IHS, the consulting firm that we use, is emphasizing that uncertainty impact as being larger, because it requires firms to insure against the risk that their market might not be there, or to hold back on possible profitable ventures because they don't know what trade policy will be. What industries are affected in Minnesota? Agriculture, for sure, has been impacted in important ways with regard to retaliatory tariffs on retaliatory tariffs by our trading partners on exports out of the United States. And manufacturing has as well. And so specifically, any manufacturing that is manufacturers that import intermediate goods. So an intermediate good is something that you use to produce a final good. So if they're importing intermediate goods from countries where the U.S. has levied tariffs, then they're paying that cost coming in. And then if they may also be shipping out to countries that have imposed tariffs on us. And so some manufacturers are getting hit on both sides there.
Well, Mr. Chair, it does occur to me, and I suspect to everyone here at the table, that volatile trade posturing on the part of the federal government is not necessarily our friend in the state of Minnesota. But Dr. Kalambokidis, switching very quickly, so in this low growth expansion environment, again, there's several factors that you talked about. It's interesting because there's, I guess most of us would say there's good things happening, but the thing is, it's like, well, but they could be better. Yeah. And so, you know, it's kind of an unusual environment, perhaps. But one of the factors has to do with consumer spending. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us whether or not Minnesotans are different in terms of consumer spending, and what is it that Minnesotans are spending on that's particularly helpful for the numbers before us?
Mr. Chairman, representative, members of the committee. So specifically how Minnesota's consumer spending might look different than the U.S.? What we do when we form our sales tax forecast is that we look at spending on those items that are included in Minnesota's sales tax. And so we don't have Minnesota-specific data on those spending items. So we look at the U.S. spending forecast on dozens of spending items, and then we construct a simulation of our sales tax base based on that. So I don't have specific information, Minnesota-specific information on different kinds of spending.
And Mr. Chair, and perhaps Mr. France, you could help me later in terms of perhaps connecting with who in state government I can pursue that very specific information. And then, Mr. Chair, I have several questions, but I know others do as well, so I'll just ask this last one. It does seem to me that, particularly when it comes to individual and sales tax, in a baby booming retiring environment, that the quicker that our state can A, find replacements, and B, help move, empower, walk with, whatever the appropriate metaphor is, but really assess that replacing community to then contribute to an individual and sales tax, and then the better for us. Can you just tell us really quickly, who are these new entrants to the workforce? I heard that, you know, it's net migration from other states. Mm-hmm. Are there international immigration contributors mm-hmm. to that as well? Are they younger folks? Are there racial, cultural distinctions between that and perhaps most recent historical flows? Just to get a feel for who we're talking about here, because I think, Mr. Chair, as we continue to design, I think our legislature has been doing a pretty good job of that in the past few years, of being able to, in fact, assist and walk with those folks. The more we know about who they are, the better we'll be able to do our work.
Dr. Colomba-Keaton.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Representative, that's a great question, and I agree that there's a role to be played with trying to ease this transition. And the sooner we get people into the workforce, the better. And there's a role for employers to pay too, and to play too, and they know it. So employers that are going to thrive in this environment are the ones who figure out how to attract those new entrants, and how to train them, and how to retain them, and how to be flexible with the workers that they do have as well, to have more flexible work hours, raise wages, whatever it takes to keep people in the market. I don't have data on the specific new entrants that I talked about in 17 and 18, the domestic net immigration. But historically, over time, as the Minnesota's population has aged, and so as the baby boom has moved into retirement age, at the same time, our population has become more diverse. And so population growth and international population growth among new immigrant communities and in migration from other countries has been an important factor in keeping our labor supply going, keeping our labor supply robust. Another reason why that net domestic immigration came at such a good time is because in those years, international immigration fell. So during the years where we had negative domestic net immigration, that we still had positive total immigration because we had international immigrants who were making up that difference. But international migration to the United States has fallen in recent years. That's not a Minnesota phenomenon, it's a national phenomenon. And so we've seen the contribution to our population growth from international newcomers go down in the last couple of years. But thank goodness we had these new people from other states come in to make up that difference.
Thank you, Dr. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess the question I have is looking at this, and this came up last year to end a session, and everybody was eyeing this money, the stadium reserve account. Is this an actual separate account that there's money in there growing that's not being spent, or is this part of the general fund budget that's there? And I guess the other question is that, and because a lot of people want to see that and they're eyeing that as ways to take that money and spend on other things, what is the earliest we can start paying off the current bonds on the stadium early, similar to what Hennepin County has, and get that off the backs of the state?
Mr. Chair, member, well, 2023 is to go right to the last question. That's when we can begin to start paying off some of those loans. As you know, we started them, and think it was in 2013 or 14, and so I think it's 2014, 7 years is the first, and so 2023 is that first, and that'll be just part of those that we could pay off. So there certainly would be obviously some savings to paying the interest savings from paying off some of those loans, and that's one aspect of the budget reserve. The stadium budget reserve. It is accounted for separately, and so that money cannot spend out of that money without specific legislative authorization. So all the money in the U.S. Bank Stadium Reserve has been specifically set aside and accounted for separately, requiring any change. So as this money grows, and where is that chart for 2021? In 2021, you can see that we'll have $124 million in that account at the end of 2021. Initially, going back in time a little bit, some of you were here when we passed the stadium legislation in 2012, and then again in 2013, we amended that statute to make up because the revenues weren't coming in as fast as we had hoped. Well, now they're coming in more than we anticipated, so that's why the balance is growing so rapidly now. And one of the things that we always wanted to do was we always wanted to make sure that we had at least 1 year's worth of debt service and other obligations in the reserve account as a minimum. And that's about $40 million a year when you include the debt service plus the other allocations that are made out of the U.S. Bank Stadium according to law. So that's about $40 million a year. That was always what we at MMB had talked about as a minimum amount that we thought we should have in there. When it goes beyond that amount, then it becomes an issue, I think, for the policymakers like you all to decide, you know, what is the appropriate use? Do you leave the money there and let it continue to grow and then use it in 2023 to begin making repayments or to use it for other needs? Now, one of the reasons it's growing is, in addition to the revenues are coming in faster than we anticipated. In 2021, the city of Minneapolis begins making their share of the payments. So we always knew in 2021 that there would be some adjustment needed because with the addition of Minneapolis paying their share, because they couldn't do it initially in 2012 because of the debt service obligations they had on the Civic Center the Exhibition Hall in Minneapolis. So there's always been this awareness that there's going to be some point where there's going to be money in this reserve account that goes beyond the needs of the original intent of the legislation. So I think that is you've hit on an issue there that that has to be, you know, that you all need to decide and talk about. Although I can say this, that a lot of us have been watching. I think all the $1.3 billion, including this money, has been spent on Twitter and other accounts throughout the last several days, many times over. But you raise a really legitimate point. I mean, clearly we've gone beyond the basic needs of having a reserve for the debt service, and now we're having more money in there, and we have to decide long term what do we do with that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess the other question I had, and I think you kind of hit on this, the balance, the carryover balance, and looking the out years 22 and 23. The carry forward balance would be 587, but if you take the 419 away from that, that's the budget reserve that's going down. We're only talking 96 million, and I don't think that's a large. I mean, it's a lot of money for you for everybody that's at the table here, but I don't think that's a large amount considering our budget. And it wouldn't take much of a, at least in my mind, it wouldn't take much of an IRP in the economy for that to go away and actually go the other direction.
Mr. Chair, Representative, well, you raise really excellent point, and that is sort of the nature of some of the one-time money, if you will, that we have with 20 and 21. When you look at the structural balance that Budget Director Raton mentioned, there's $220 million of ongoing revenue increase. So the revenues were outpacing expenditures by $220 million in 22 and 23. If you sort of look at that as the ongoing balance, then really about $1.1 billion of the $1.3 billion you could really look at as one-time money because it's not, we don't see that ongoing. And as we all know, when you spend money in one biennium on ongoing projects, it gets more expensive and you at least have to double it in the next biennium or more. So clearly any serious spending for ongoing programming is going to have to be, we're going to have to think about what's that do for our long-term budget stability. So this whole concept of how much do we have in the way of resources in 22 and 23 is something that we've had that issue for several forecast years in a row now where the resources in the out year, the out biennium, is less than the current resources in this biennium or the current biennium. And that provides challenges. And I think that we have to sort of be very, very careful what we spend this year and looking toward the long term, especially if we pay back the $491 million to the budget reserve.
I might interject with Representative Nelson, your first question. Tentatively, we are going to have our first Ways and Means meeting on the 17th of February, and one of the issues that I have tentatively on the list is the stadium reserve, so we'll have a further discussion about that. It was a good question now, but I mean, just so you're aware that if you're interested in that issue, we are going to be, as the commissioner indicated, we probably should have a discussion about what's needed there and how that's handled in the future. We have about nine people. We don't have a floor session today, so I just want you to know we're Nancy's got the list here, and we're just going to take people in the order that the hands went up. So, Representative Druskowski, your hand was up next.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, members, the apparent giddiness and zeal of some of the members and the administration around the table here to spend the people's money is palpable. At the same time, I think it's important to note and look. We have a biennial budget now that is the largest in the history of the state at $48.5 billion, roughly. Additionally, it's apparent that policy and decisions have socked away and locked away another $2.5 billion of the people's money for future spending, yet to be decided. Just to anticipate and spend that future zeal and giddiness that might somehow present itself then. Additionally, members, if we look at the spending side of the equation presented here in the report, it's apparent that the last legislative process rendered decision makings and budgets that overestimated the amount of money that our government would need. You see in E through 12 education, we actually budgeted $24 million too much. Almost $100 million too much in health and human services, and debt service, we budgeted $51 million too much, netting actually an over estimate of the amount of money that we needed that was actually budgeted. So I would hope, Mr. Chair and members, and a question for Mr. Franz is, will the government be coming back next session for a budget reconciliation proposal that will decrease the budget to match the actual need, especially as I look at HHS, E through 12, and debt service? Will we actually have a proposal from the administration to spend less in the budget because, as we can see, we were off the mark and we overestimated the amount of need here in the budget process that ended back during the regular session?
Mr. Chair, Representative, well, you know, what I'm giddy about is I'm giddy about the fact that the people now have a $2.4 billion in reserve that will protect the programming that you all voted that they should have. And so I think when you look at the education cuts we make in a recession, when you look at the higher education and K-12 borrowing that we do, you look at the services that we cut, this is designed exactly for the people to be protected in the event of an economic downturn. So this is the people's reserve. If there ever was one, this would be it. So I'm giddy about that because I think that's what, you know, when you buy insurance or you set aside money for a rainy day and it rains, it's kind of nice to have it there. And it's there for a purpose, not just to run government. It's there for the people to get the services that you all voted that they should have. So that's what I'm giddy about. But, you know, in terms of matching revenues to expenditures, you know, this budget, every budget is difficult. Everyone it's hard to get right on the money. I mean, clearly what we try to do is make the best possible estimates that we can, and things change. And I think it was John Maynard Keynes that once said that when the facts change, my mind changes. What do you do, sir? So that's what I do is when I look at the new data, the new information, I decide, and we all sit around and say, well, what's happened? What's different? We're never going to get it, you know, exactly on. And, but we, you know, but we do take seriously when we're wrong. Why were we wrong? What happened? Why did people not enroll as fast as we thought they would? And sometimes in a growing economy like we have,
you have income levels for certain people that are going up, and they sort of phase out of some of the programming that we have in human services. So there's a wide range of issues that we have, and what I can guarantee you is that Governor Walz will hold our feet to the fire, and he will say, as we start working on the biennial budget probably early in the next year, for the next biennium after this, what do we really need? And not only what do we really need, what does it cost, and how can we start evaluating more effectively what it is we're doing? One of the things we agreed on this last session was to increase our results management, where we use results data or evidence-based data to evaluate programming. So I take that challenge seriously, Representative, that we should do more to make sure what we're doing is working, it's effective, it's cost-effective, and we have the right amount of money. So we take that very seriously, and I appreciate your concern along those lines.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Franz. I didn't hear a yes, but maybe something around the edge of that. I'm hoping that the administration does come back and help us right-size this budget. Obviously, it's too big. We formed out a budget that was larger than the need was. It's very apparent in black and white here. And hopefully, we'll have a budget reconciliation process that will turn some of that money back loose to the people that it truly belongs to, and that's the hardworking people of Minnesota that work hard every day to generate it. A specific question, Commissioner, and then maybe Budget Director Ratan could help out too. In the HHS area, we over-budgeted by about almost $100 million. If you could review for us again, Budget Director, where that money came from, and was there any money that isn't going to be spent between now and the end of the biennium in that HHS area that's due to the administration going after and rooting out the fraud and waste and corruption in the DHS, the multitude of DHS programs that has really plagued that agency. I'm curious if any numbers are reflected in there that starts to really address that issue, those many issues.
Mr. Chair, Representative, what I'd like to start with on that Health and Human Services change is that's a 0.7% change from end of session estimates. So it's on a percentage basis, it's relatively small in terms of the magnitude of change. And in Health and Human Services in particular, it's a more difficult bill area to forecast, because unlike E-12 education, where we have a fairly good understanding of how many students are in our public schools and a fairly predictable progression ratio from one grade to the next. In Health and Human Services, a lot is driven by economic conditions in terms of who enrolls in programming. So the biggest contributor to the change in this forecast is fewer people enrolling in MA basic care. And that's for the most part due to improved economic conditions. And so I just want to highlight that some of those changes in forecast are due to conditions in the economy and conditions outside the control of the Department of Human Services, more about the number of people using public programs. To speak to your specific question about fraud, I would have to defer to the Department of Human Services. This forecast reflects the best estimates for current use of existing programs.
So, Mr. Chair.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Budget Director. Budget Director, are you aware of any of the $97 million that is attributable to actually recapturing some of the waste, fraud, and abuse, the hundreds of millions of dollars in waste, fraud, and abuse in DHS?
Mr. Chair, Representative, this forecast does incorporate some of the issues that have been in the news recently in terms of payment errors and how those will be corrected going forward. One of the more significant ones that's been in the news was the tribal payment issue. That actually nets to zero in the forecast because it assumes a repayment of the federal government, but it also assumes, based on current law, a collection back from the tribe.
So, Mr. Chair, and last question. Thank you. So, Budget Director Ratan, of the $97 million, how much of that in a dollar amount is attributable to recapturing from some of the waste, fraud, and abuse that the huge Department of Human Services in our state, Health and Human Services, has had.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I think we can follow up on that and include the Department of Human Services in the answer. I'm not sure I'm tracking with all that you're including in that number. So I think discussing it with the Department of Human Services offline to help get you an answer would be best.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Budget Director Raton. Like you, the waste, fraud, and abuse is so widespread that I, too, have a hard time remembering all of it. Thank you.
Similarly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate the chair's comments early on the reserves. When you first started your talk after the presentation, I haven't been here as long as you, but I've been through, I remember when Representative Hamilton and I came in, and we've gone through some tough budget years where we didn't have that reserve, and it's not fun for anybody, and you're cutting stuff that you is really important to people, and you're hurting people, and that's a real thing. It really happens. And so I really value, I don't know if giddy is the word that I would use, but I think we all should be proud that we have a reserve. I think it's the right thing for Minnesotans, and I think we all can look at them in the face and say, I don't know what's too much, but I think of your own situation as a family, and if you're not, if you don't have a little bit of reserves, you can get in trouble pretty fast. You know, it could be a furnace or a transmission in your car, and well, you just don't know. But anyways, I'm pretty happy that we have that, and I think we all should be really proud of that and leaving that legacy for Minnesota. My real question is, so I'm lucky enough to be on the bonding committee, and I've been in many of your districts. I've been down to and I know Mr. Franz and your team, you've been all over the state as well, and I think we've had 18 days of stops, about $5 billion of requests, 230 presentations. So we've seen a few. We've been to Representative Hamilton's and Schumacher's to see wastewater and treatment and different community needs. We've been all the way up to International Falls. We even went to Minneapolis, of all places. amazing projects and needs all over the state. We all love the opera or the Chatfield where we saw Representative Davis, where he was a wrestling champion, and they're trying to build out that. But anyways, the point is the needs are great all over the state, and I can look around at every one of you because I've seen you in your communities and the needs that are out there. But so I guess my question is this, what could we do as a bill? How big? And a lot of it's not fancy. Keep in mind, I see Chair Bernardi had to step out for a second, but a lot of it goes to roofs and different things on college campuses around the state, and a lot of it's that, wastewater treatment, roads and bridges. Right here in St. Paul, there's a bridge that's fallen. My community out in the East Metro, we have an intersection that needs help, highway. These are just common all over the state. But what would a bill what size of a bill could we do and maintain our good credit ratings and our, I realize we're not going to go to that number, but what is that number? How big is it? I mean, historically, we've never gone beyond the billion, but my understanding is it's a pretty big number that we could reasonably afford as a state and protect and I think make investments. And so what would be that robust bill that you mentioned?
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative, the robust number is still, I'm not sure what that right number is. One of the things that we've had a debt service guidelines in place since, I think, 2008, or it's been about 11 years. And we have three guidelines, and they're designed to measure how much debt we have outstanding or issued with respect to the total personal income in the state of Minnesota. We adopted that in part because that's a little bit how the rating agencies and other people look at the ability to pay of a state. Then our third guideline deals with paying off a debt in a certain number of years versus other years. Now, we've analyzed the first two guidelines and come up with about a $3.5 billion debt that we could issue in 2020 and still not go beyond those debt capacity guidelines for guidelines one and two. It would disrupt the payback period a little bit that we'd have to work on. But that's sort of the outside number. I think one of the things that we were looking at, and remember the rating agencies examine us from this perspective too. So if you look at total state debt, the total state debt measured as a percentage of our state's total personal income, and our state's total personal income for this forecast is $354 billion a year. That represents, in Minnesota, relatively small state income. We're right in the middle of the pack when it comes to other states in terms of our total state debt compared to total state personal income. If you look at the debt service, the amount we pay every year or every biennium as a percentage of the state revenue, that also is low. We're in the top 18 states when it comes to having low debt service compared to our general fund. So we're really in a spot where we don't believe we've been overly using bonding or borrowing as a way to invest. We think we've managed that fairly well. Clearly, there's a lot of differences. We have gone over $1 billion, by the way, several times. But the really key, I think, is deciding what we're comfortable with in terms of what should that annual debt payment be. But I think, and I talked about this on Thursday, and the governor, I think, really reiterated the same thing. We want to make sure that what's in it is what works for Minnesota. I mean, the key is what are the kinds of programs that really local communities or the University of Minnesota or Minnesota State or our water treatment facilities, what kind of investment overall will help the state continue to make progress? Because one of the things that we've been really good about in Minnesota is investing in the long term. We do that. We manage our budget in the long term. We try to manage our resources in the long term. And I think that's one of the things that the credit rating agencies look at us and gave us a AAA rating, in part because of the ability of us to have a reserve, budget reserve, but also to take care of our infrastructure. In fact, if you refuse and don't really live up to what you should maintain in your infrastructure, credit rating agencies will start to look at that as a credit risk, because at some point, things are going to fail and you're not going to be able to maintain those. So there are just so many areas where we can, around this state, help with leveraging the money, the assets that we have, by borrowing and making those long-term investments. So the governor, as you know, has been traveling around as well, which is a little bit unusual, and very engaged and interested in what is the right bonding bill. We will release that on January the 15th. We're obviously working on it full time now, trying to decide and present to him and the lieutenant governor what's that package look like, so that people around the state will go that this really is a bonding bill that fits all of Minnesotans around the state. So we're focusing on the nature of what's in the bonding bill, and I don't know what that right number is yet, but I look forward to coming out and working with the governor with a number that serves the purpose that we need to engage in here. Thank you.
Representative Lilly, at the beginning of the meeting, I thought some questions about a capital investment bill might come up. And so at the last minute, I asked Mr. Marks to put together a few numbers, and I did express some of those thoughts with the commissioner. Just different scenarios what the debt service would be. This committee doesn't deal with the projects, but we deal with the debt service. So, Mr. Marks, on the back of the envelope numbers that you have, if you could just share those with the committee, and then we can refine them later if necessary.
Well, Mr. Chair and members, these aren't exactly back of the envelope. These are numbers that MMB has supplied us, but
let's be clear.
The forecast assumes a $755 million bonding bill in 2020, and then $240 million in 2021, and those are 10-year averages. There's nothing magic about them. They're what happened in the even year, the last 10 even years, it's the average of those numbers, and what happened in the last 10 odd years. So $755 million is what's built into the forecast for the 2020 session bonding bill. Each additional $1 million in bonding in 2020 would cost about $16,000 in debt service in fiscal 2021, and about $127,000 in debt service in fiscal 2023. Just to put that in perspective then, a $1 billion bill would cost an additional $3.9 million in 2021 and $31 million in 2022-23. $1.5 billion bonding bill would cost an additional $11.9 million, and this is additional above the forecast, $11.9 million in 2021 and $94.4 million in 2022-23. Any $2 billion bonding bill would cost $19.8 million in 2021 and $157.8 million in 2022-23. And the 22-23 cost being much higher is a function of the timing on when the bonds are sold. And there's an assumption of no debt service in additional debt service cost in fiscal 2020 anymore. So it begins in fiscal 2021 and then ramps up in 22 and 23 as more bonds are sold.
And having spent a little time on the committee through the years, you know, the type of projects and which ones are shovel ready and all of that can influence those numbers as well, in terms of how quickly a project comes online. So obviously when we get ready with the budget resolution, we'll add further discussion about the size of a bill, input from the governor's office, and also what we have available for resources. While I'm at it, I should point out, I view, and I mentioned this at the press conference the other day, this forecast is a benchmark. It tells us where we are today. We're going to be building the budget off the February forecast, and things may change up, they may change down, they may remain relatively flat. I did ask the state economist the other day about the probabilities of different scenarios. Maybe you can share those with us as we move ahead. But basically, this is built on kind of the stay the course scenario. But if you could just share those percentages that you talked about the other day when you gave us a briefing.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, so the chairman, I believe, is referring to the scenarios that are provided to us by the macroeconomic consulting firm. So they give us a baseline economic scenario with thousands of data points, and that we used the baseline in constructing our forecast that you heard today. They also provide us with two alternative scenarios, one a more optimistic scenario and the other more pessimistic. And each of those has a narrative associated with it, meaning here's how we think the things could work out a little work out better than what our baseline is, and here's how we think things could work out less well than what our baseline says. And then they assign a subjective probability to those two scenarios, to all three scenarios. So they give 55% probability to the baseline, which means that that's the one that they think is most likely to play out. They give a 10% probability to a more optimistic scenario, and then a 35% probability to a more pessimistic scenario. And their pessimistic scenario has a recession starting next year in their forecast. That the probability assigned to the pessimistic scenario, to all of them, has changed over the course of the last 12 months. They have taken some of the probability that they'd assigned to the baseline in the optimistic scenario and moved that to the pessimistic. So they've increased their expectation on the pessimistic scenario. But the baseline scenario that you saw today, as you saw in our in the real GDP forecast, does not have a recession in it. It has the growth that goes down to 1.5% in 2023.
And I should have used the phrase or word baseline. I didn't stay the course, but that was essentially what I was referring to. Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, no, that's helpful information. I do want to remind everyone, every year is different. All the risks are always different in these forecasts, but the difference between the last November forecast in 2018 and February 2019 was $500 million decline. So things can happen, and so I warn all those people out there spending money on Twitter. The $1.3 billion is here today, and we need to wait until February to decide what, in fact, we all have to make decisions on going forward.
And I've had a few phone calls already.
Yeah, I've had a few.
Let's see. Next is Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My first question is for Dr. Kalamkidis, and it relates to the slide for the forecast surplus versus budget reserve. And Doctor, just for clarification, you mentioned in your remarks that you set that percentage based upon an economic analysis that your department puts together? I'm sure it's in coordination with the IHI and other economic factors. And I'm just hoping that you might just elaborate a little more on that in terms of the variability, in terms of how often it's changed, and what determinants go into raising or lowering that. Mm-hmm. And I have several follow-ups, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chairman, representative, members of the committee. So our we generate the budget reserve target percentage, which is a percentage of general fund revenues. It's not a forecast, so it looks at revenue volatility that we've had up to this point. It's not forecasting volatility going forward. And so the two main things that can affect the forecast, affect the target, the percentage, is that if the volatility of any of the underlying tax basis changes, so the tax base for income tax, the base for the sales tax, the base for the corporate, if the volatility of any of those things changes, then that will affect the target, the measured volatility, and that can happen if something fundamentally changes in the economy. So we look at data on those tax bases, and when I say measure volatility, we're looking at how those things grow over time. And if you draw a straight trend line, you can see how the base grows over time. But in reality, the tax base moves around that trend line. And so we're measuring how much it moves up and down around that trend line. And so when it moves more around that trend line, that means volatility has changed. So if volatility of any of the underlying bases change, then that changes our percentage. And the other thing that can change the percentage is if the portfolio of tax revenues that we have in our tax system changes. So if we shift, if law changes, tax law changes the share that we take, that we have for income, sales, corporate, and other taxes, then that can affect the overall volatility of the system. So we kind of look at it as a portfolio of these revenue streams. So those are the two things that can affect it. The 4.9%, since we have been doing this, and it has been part of statute that the target is statutory, and that we add money to the budget reserve when there's a positive forecast balance in November, it has changed. The percentage has changed very little. It's been in the vicinity of 5% all of that time. So 5.1 down to 4.8, I can provide you the history of the target, but the percentage hasn't changed that much. The dollar value, the level of the target changes either if the percentage has changed or when forecast revenues have changed. So we set the target in September at 4.9%, and then we reforecast revenues in this forecast and then apply that target to that percentage to it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Albright.
Thank you. Doctor, on the next page, we talk about the support that you're receiving from IHI, the economics with regard to forecast for the GDP, both for past and future years. And I've noted that every subsequent year, once we complete it and we have the actual, we don't actually go back and see what they were forecasting. And I know that there's some volatility, and obviously if you're marketing your wears and tears, you're not going to say what you forecast based upon what your actual is, because you might be wrong. And, you know, the old adage is if you put 10 economists in a room, present company accepted, you're going to get 12 opinions. And so I'm wondering if you might afford us the opportunity to see what the forecasted GDP might have been for those years versus forecast, because as we all know, for the last better part of the decade, we've been kind of mentioned that 1.5% GDP was all that we could hope for. Mm-hmm. Subsequent to that, we've had some very robust quarters. And subsequent to that, now the new norm is something north of 2.5% or almost 3%. So I think, you know, to expect these numbers in the outlying years, you know, trailing off, and going back to my earlier submission, respectfully, I think these are all forecasted numbers. Mm-hmm. Subject to change every time that we get together. Yep. So just a comment on that one. If we could receive what was forecast for each one of those years and what change occurred that led you to change your forecast. On the I'm going to move to business investment slowdown, your forecasted risks. Could you quantify either in dollar or percent what you mean by investment and slowdown?
Mr. Chairman?
Dr. Kiedis?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, members of the committee, first let me actually start to answer your first question about forecast change, and we can try to flesh out a more complete answer for you. But for your reference, on page 69 of the forecast book, we do present a table showing how IHS's forecast has changed for particular years over the course of the time they're forecasting those years. So you can see how their forecast for real GDP for 19, 20, 21, 18, 17, 16, back to 14, you can see how those forecasts changed over time. So you can see that. We also present some alternative forecasts by other forecasters, so you can see where they lie there. And the Council of Economic Advisors statement, well, and it's also in our forecast book, we always make an assessment of where IHS is relative to other macroeconomic forecasters, and we point out when they differ. And for this one, they're very close to what the blue chip consensus forecast is for both 19 and 20. And then regarding seeing how far off a forecast might be when you end up there, we do produce that. So 2 weeks after every forecast, we produce a report showing how, based on our history of how our forecasts ended up, or how the biennium ended up relative to what our forecast was. And so I welcome that, your feedback on that report when you see that in 2 weeks. And now I've forgotten what your other question was.
You mentioned in your
business investment
slowdown, you elaborated to the extent that while consumer spending has increased and in a number of regards, I would agree, but I'm curious as to the kind of the connectedness to the other forecasted risks that you share. Is there a dollar amount or a percentage point that either IHS or others are attributing to business investment slowdown?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, members of the committee, so we discussed that on page 13 of the forecast book, and we have a bar chart that I didn't put in the presentation because I thought we had too many charts. I had too many charts. But it shows the forecast change for business fixed investment. And for everybody's benefit, what we mean by business fixed investment is business purchases of equipment, structures, and intellectual property. So what businesses purchase in order to produce goods and services. And so it's tied to the manufacturing economy, although it's not only the manufacturing economy. And so we discuss in the book the relationship between the slowdown in manufacturing at the U.S. level, which has resulted in a decline in employment in that sector, and change in business fixed investment. And so in that chart, we show that the forecast change for 2019 was that in February, IHS had expected 3.6% annual percentage growth in business fixed investment, and in this forecast, it's 2.2%. For next year, they had 2.8% in February, and now they have 1.7%. And then there are relatively smaller changes in the subsequent years, but overall, it is a decline in growth in business fixed investment throughout the forecast horizon.
Thank you, Ms. Doctor. For the budget director, on the next couple pages, when we talk about the changes in the kind of the separate accounts of the state budget, I want to draw your attention to Health and Human Services, particularly you see a lower enrollment for the MA basic care, and I understand about that based upon the surge in economic outlook. It seems logical. But I'm wondering if you or commissioner would elaborate in terms of what's going on at DHS right now, and what of any concerns or considerations you mentioned that you're working on in the next biennial budget. Doesn't sound like we should be thinking about a supplemental budget based upon what's on the bottom line after you suggest that we include inflation. But I'm wondering how, what effect that would have on tribal communities, individuals, or in particular counties that are now saying that we're going to have kind of a serious conversation about monies that are owed back to the state. Counties are really kind of purviewed as administrators of a state appropriation, and now we're asking them to come up with extra money from the taxpayers in those counties. So I'm wondering how you're reconciling those differences.
Director Dodd.
Representative, Mr. Chair, so I talked a bit about the tribal payment issue to the previous representative's question, in that we are assuming repayment from the tribal governments in this forecast, which means that the repayment to the federal government is offset by a receipt back from the tribal governments. That's because that's what current law requires. And so our forecast is a current law forecast. We fully recognize that this will be a discussion during the legislative session, but our forecast is a current law forecast, and so that's what we assume in the forecast. Same with a separate issue that has been covered in the news about chemical dependency services offered at what's called IMDs, Institutes of Mental Disease. These are institutions with beds, I believe, of 16 or more. That's another topic that's been covered. This forecast does assume repayment to the federal government, and there is a portion of that that is attributable to counties. That county share is assumed in the forecast, and again, that's because current law requires collecting back from counties and tribes in the tribal payment issue. Again, it's something that I'm assuming will be discussed during the legislative session, but we assume current law with the forecast.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I'd like to go a little bit further with your invitation. And, you know, I've been speaking a lot with Commissioner Harpstad, and as you know, has been there just a little over 90 days. And I think I can truthfully say that both the governor and Commissioner Harpstad and the senior management at DHS is concerned about some of these issues that have come up in terms of discovering them and not discovering them as early as maybe they would have liked to. Clearly, there are some challenges to make sure that our internal controls, which is, you know, how we try to manage state government, both from a macro point of view as well as from our view as a forecast, but also from a micro point of view from the different agencies, is something that's important to us to make sure we don't have any fraud, waste, or abuse. But when these issues arise, one of the things that Commissioner Harpstad is doing is focusing on what are the ways that she can institute more control, more analysis of what's going on. I mean, she's studying a lot of different ways to manage that agency and studying the best way for that agency to be structured as well. I mean, there's ongoing issues about how we should go about doing that. So we're in the process of doing a lot of that work. I think I'm concerned about it. I know the governor's concerned about it, and I know Commissioner Harpstad is working daily on trying to make sure that these unusual circumstances are dealt with and they don't happen, but when they do happen, you know about them early. But the goal is to really analyze and put in better controls to monitor these kinds of issues going forward, and I know that that's what she's working on full time.
Commissioner, thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I appreciate, you know, strong and robust process controls. That's forward-looking. And what we're looking at right now, as the Commissioner Harpstad talked about when she presented her 90-day plan before Health and Human Services Finances last week, I didn't hear a lot in terms of what they're going to do to rectify. So to your answer to my earlier question, it sounds to me like the errors of the state and the largest agency in Minnesota are going to some extent, be the responsibility financially of the counties based upon assertions and promises or statements made by the agency to the counties in terms of how that's going, how it was supposed to be done in the past, but, oh, by the way, now we've made an error and you've got to come up with the money. How would you respond to counties saying it wasn't our fault that you overspent money and now you're making us to double down and have to come up with more money out of our county taxpayers to placate and fix the problem that's at a state agency? How would you respond to that?
Mr. Chair, Representative, well, I know how they are responding. That is to talk to them. I think one of the issues that they want to discuss with the counties is the best way to proceed. The fact that we have these issues in their current law, as the budget director Raton described, doesn't mean that we can't get together and talk about ways to solve those problems together. So I know that DHS and Commissioner Harpstead is in dialogue with those counties about that very specific issue.
Mr. Chair and Commissioner, I have a question with regard to page 12, when you're talking about the planning estimates and we're talking about the budget reserve. And the only red number on that page is, to my way of looking at it, a bit of an anomaly. We have established in state statute, and as Dr. Kalambakidis said, it is her purview to set what that percentage is. I understand that, but now it seems to me, and I welcome your response, it seems like that $491 million transfer, while we talk about a structural balance, it's really to cover the over-expenditure that was put into law in the last budget based upon three people in a room deciding what the budget is, and you took it out of the budget reserve as opposed to hold the line on spending. Because what the budget reserve, with all due respect, the budget reserve is there for a rainy day when economic conditions, to the doctor's point, change materially. The only thing that changed materially in the last budget biennium decisions were that three people in the room decided to spend more than what both caucuses agreed to. That's not an economic change. That's a decision proactively made by three people that affect all the Minnesota taxpayers. How would you respond to that?
Mr. Chair, Representative, well, I think we need to back up to the beginning of the session, number one. Certainly, the governor had a proposed budget that would have raised revenues and fully supported all of the spending that he proposed. The House had a proposed a budget that they passed that would have increased revenues and paid for the programs they wanted to spend, and the Senate had another proposal that was in contrary, with odds with those different budget proposals. So in a classic situation where you have divided government, no one's going to get everything. And so I think what you saw was the coming together of three different leaders, the Speaker, the Majority Leader of the Senate, and the Governor, to try to reconcile the spending that they all felt was necessary. And yet, on the other hand, there was a decision to have a tax bill that raised revenue, but not raise revenue in a net way or increasing revenues in a net position, so that left an agreed upon spending amount without an agreed upon revenue raising amount to cover that spending, and that's why the $491 million was used to cover that spending that was approved to make sure there was no budget imbalance in 22 and 23. So it was a accumulation and a culmination of a lot of hard work by a lot of chairs working with their leaders coming together during the end of session, and a lot of the work was done at the committee level, but it's true that toward the end there was an accommodation that was reached by the three leaders because of the need to reach a budget agreement. So this was, the budget reserve can always be tapped if the legislature says, notwithstanding the law, they want to tap into it for whatever reason. We believe that the proper statutory purpose for spending out of there is for an economic downturn, but in this case it was used to reach a budget deal that all three leaders agreed upon. So I think that I would just reiterate the fact that that's how the process worked. It was divided government. We reached a budget deal that all three leaders were able to sign off on time, and I'll leave it at that.
Mr. Chair, I'll respectfully disagree with the commissioner on the use of
more questions. We're almost at the 2 hour mark.
It's unfortunate that we become a process where, process improvements are more important than consequences for past actions. It's also unfortunate that our budget decision-making process has morphed into, if you can't cover what's in the checkbook, you will find another little, you know, safe, you know, budget reserve and pull what you need out of there to cover it in the tails. It wasn't a rainy day fund. You're making it into not a rainy day fund, but to cover the largesse of this administration and the decisions of increasing a budget that is out of control. And rather than an economic downturn, we see continued economic growth. That does not support raiding a rainy day fund. That supports making sure that we're diligent about what we're spending Minnesota taxpayers' money on. I'll leave it at that.
Thank you. Representative Davids, if folks can be somewhat brief, so we can honor our general time frame of about 2 hours.
Did he say that to you, Drez? Oh, just on. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A couple of things here. First of all, I think that these results, and first of all, I'd like to thank the three folks that testified today. Nice forecast, direct result of the 2017 tax bill. Generally, tax bills take about 2 years to show what they're made of, and I think it's very clear, undisputable, that the 2017 tax bill has put us in this situation. That being said, with Commissioner Franz, I was curious about your definition of robust, but I think you handled that very well with Chairman Lilly's question there. But I do have a question on page 20 of the budget forecast. It shows that personal income is up about 4%. Spending is more than that. How long is that sustainable, and how do we sustain that?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative, well, thank you for the question. You know, one of the key concerns that I think we all share, the legislature and the administration, we all share, is managing and making budget decisions that take into account the reality of how fast our revenues anticipated to grow, or do we want to change that? Do we want to add to that or subtract from that? Same thing with expenditures. I think the key is that we have the fiscal discipline within this committee and other committees to analyze proposals in a way that keep their eye on that long-term revenue growth, projected revenue growth, and expenditure growth, and how are we affecting those in the decisions that we make going forward. And I think that yes, that, you know, that if you look at 22 and 23, you see the $220 million difference in revenues growing faster than expenditures is pretty close. And so we can easily be changed based upon different factors in the economy. So we're concerned about that, as I think you are. And I think the key is to make sure that we make sound, long-term fiscal decisions to keep us on track. That's all I can really advise.
Representative David.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I'm just flashing back to this time of the year in 2010 when we were presented with a $6.2 billion shortfall. So in my mind, when I look at this forecast here, I do feel very good about what we have done, because we did a $6.2 billion shortfall and took care of that. And you and I, when you were, we both had different roles at that time. So I do want to thank you for those efforts back then and what you're doing today. So,
Mr. Chair, Representative, I do have to tell the story that at that time when I met the governor in late 2010 to be interviewed to be revenue commissioner and had a good meeting, and he offered me the job, and I went home to tell my wife about it, and she said, well, that's great. Did you accept? And I said, yes. And she said, well, how are you going to solve the $6.2 billion deficit? I said, well, give me a few days, and maybe we'll come up with something. But those were tough times. I mean, I appreciate the recognition there, Mr. Chair, Representative. But you know, back in those days, those were tough days. And so, thank you for that recognition.
And several of us had different roles at that point in time, Representative. next is Representative Vogel. Thank you for your patience.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I tend to look at the bonding thing a lot. And I'm hearing $3 billion, and I think Commissioner might have said that in his presentation, that we might be looking at something like that. I haven't heard, though, exactly, once that's fully phased in, what the annual debt service would be on that. I know that you know, I saw the 3.9 and 31 million and so forth, but is there any estimate of what $3 billion in bonding cost the general fund a year in payments?
Mr. Marks said he doesn't have it readily available.
And I can understand that. You know, for the sake of discussion.
Unless the department has it off the top of the
unless, okay. So for the sake of discussion, let's just assume that it's 4%. That's $120 million a year, $240 million a biennium. We just got done talking about the 27% decrease in the budget reserve amount that we need to put in. And I guess as I listen to that, either we shouldn't be putting in 4.9% or 3.6% is okay, because that's what we're going to. So I take that $491 million, especially being in the financial industry. If I was analyzing that, I'd say that's kind of just funny money that's been there. So the bottom line is, realistically, if we weren't playing with those numbers, we would have a $271 million deficit in the out biennium 2022-23, which, if you've got another $120 million a year, $240 million a biennium in debt to service, you're well over half a billion dollars that you're projecting in that out biennium by spending money on bonding, which I'm not saying that we don't need to do things. I'm not saying that interest rates aren't low. But we are putting ourselves in a position, just like if you buy a new house, you buy a new car, you're going to have to make those payments for the length of that term. If we take the funny money out of it, we add the additional debt that we're doing, we're looking at putting the taxpayers of Minnesota possibly on the hook for half a billion dollars of deficit in 2020 or 2022 and 2023. And I know that it may be a little unfair to just throw out numbers and say, Mr. Commissioner, would those assumptions that I'm making be correct? But any comments?
Mr. Chair, I think the Budget Director has a comment for you.
Mr. Chair and Representative, I just want to make sure I'm tracking with the math that you were just doing. So the 491 that's coming out of the reserve, that doesn't contribute to the structural situation between revenues and expenditures, because that just adjusts the reserve target line. And so even with the 491 being restored, there's still 220 in structural balance between revenues and expenditures.
But
22-23.
Mr. Chair, Representative, but your point about, you know, adding debt, I think we would never disagree that you really want to be careful. What is our biennial debt service? About $1.1 billion, I think it is, something like that, Bill, something like that. And so, and that's, like I said, if you compare that to the other states, we're in the top 18 states in terms of having modest debt to general fund revenues. So clearly you want to watch that. I mean, we don't disagree about being careful about how much you add. And I've never said we should do $3 or $3.5 billion yet. But I don't disagree with the need to be careful about that and monitor what is that going to do to your budget going forward. And so I don't know if that answers your question, but.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I realize it was an example of what can happen here. But I think just in prudence, I hear this, that we've got this surplus and now we can bond for more. I did have a question. When you have debt service of $1,132,000, does that include just general obligation, or is that all appropriation as well as GOs for the biennium?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I'm learning from my right that it's just the general obligation. That number represents
right.
Just general obligation.
So, you know, it might be helpful as people are looking at things to actually have the actual debt service that we're doing. That, one other clarification, I think, Commissioner, you said that that we have a test for debt service. And it's always been my understanding that we have a test for debt outstanding as well as debt maturity. But we don't have a test for debt service. In other words, looking how much of our general fund we're having to expend for the payments. Would that be fair to say?
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes.
So I think as we look at this, you know, and I've always advocated that for prudence, we really have to start looking at how much of our budget are we spending in dollars that could be going to other things for debt service. And if we get aggressive and get into that $3 billion range, how much more are we taking from education, from roads and everything else? Because that's going to be there for 20 years as that amortizes. And I think we just have to be really cautious on that. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
We have next Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner, my questions pertain to the Healthcare Access Fund. I'm wanting to know what the current and projected balances of that fund, what they are. Is it reflected in the forecast? And then I have a follow-up question.
Mr. Chair, Budget Director Ray Tong will answer that. As she's looking for that number, I want to reiterate the fact that we have a budget book that's on our website at what is it? What's our website? It's mn.gov/MMB under the Forecast and Updates tab. So if you haven't had a chance to look at that, it's a great, it's a really good read, and I recommend it highly.
Mr. Chair, Representative, the Healthcare Access Fund is carried in our consolidated fund statement, which is being released today on our website. That usually lags a couple days behind the general fund forecast, but there's also a narrative explanation of the changes to the Healthcare Access Fund. The current projections for the end of 2021, the projected balance of the Healthcare Access Fund is $538.93 million. The end of 2023, the balance would be $279.696 million. So there is a declining balance, and that's because beginning in 2021, the structural balance in that fund is negative currently.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And to the director, does that reflect the legislation that was passed this legislative session reinstating at least a portion of that provider tax?
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes, it does. Okay.
And all right. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My final question is, the way those dollars are allocated, is that clearly outlined as directed by the legislature going forward?
Mr. Chair, Representative, it is, yes, and there's a portion of it that is paying for medical assistance and a portion of it that is paying for MinnesotaCare, as well as some programming at DHS and MDH, and that is all detailed in the statement that will be posted online.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, that gets us to the bottom of the list. Just a quick comment, Representative Albright. I'm not really that interested in debating that use of that money because I was not one that was very favorable towards taking that 400 and some million from the reserve account. But when you folks were in control with the premium subsidy program, you took $326,945,000 out of the reserve account for that purpose. And my only point, rather than debating it, is to simply say both sides of the aisle have some guilt on that. And I'm not debating the purpose. It's just something that happened. When we had the press conference that I alluded to the other day, both Senator Cohen and I commented about the need to protect that reserve because I do view it as a rainy day fund. And I was at the table when the negotiations were going on, I think, until the Friday night before the decision was made to narrow it down to three people. And I know how difficult things were near the end there to just kind of get the package together with, as was pointed out by the commissioner, divided government. And so I would hope as we move forward that we do protect that reserve account because, as I pointed out, I was here. In fact, I chaired the Education Division of Appropriations. We had an Appropriations Committee back then, and we had six special sessions. And when you don't have a reserve account, there's cost shifting that goes on. At that point in time, for example, the University of Minnesota had to have some significant tuition increases. They did it as a one-time approach, if I recall correctly, but there was a burden shifted onto students because the state didn't have a reserve to back up what those obligations were. And the other systems, we didn't have Minsky at the time, did much the same thing. I could point to several special sessions where we've had meltdowns, and more than once I've been a chair of the fiscal committee when that happened. So I'm not saying whether the outcome of that 326 was good or bad. It's just that the reserve was used for that purpose. And Representative Davids, you wanted to comment. I think you were involved with the issue at the time.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. It was my bill, and it was a brilliant way to handle things because what the premium subsidy did, it saved the private insurance market, reduced premiums 25%. And I want to publicly thank Chair Liebling for renewing it this year. For Chair Liebling carrying the bill to renew the premium subsidy. If she had not done that, which I fully support, if she had not done that, premiums would have gone up 50%, and this is all a result of Obamacare destroying the private health market.
And I'm just saying that without debating the purpose, I'm not arguing about the purpose, but just that the reserve was used at that point in time to accomplish what turned out to be a positive, but just saying that both sides of the aisle have used the reserve for something other than the purpose of a downturn in the economy and what the reserve is generally there for. If you've filled out your per diem slips, I'll be here today and tomorrow and get them signed and in. And with that, I want to thank the three of you. And with that, meeting adjourned.